One of the poems I nerdily learnt a few years ago in a bid to have 100 party tricks committed to memory and become a sort of human poetry jukebox is this wonderful paean, this hymn of invocation or thanks to the gods of destiny and true essence, which is to say those gods who allow us to become and maybe even fully inhabit in a celebratory rather than denigratory way the glory of our creaturely existence. This existence, I've started to believe recently, manifests, at least to begin with, via certain archetypal structures that we call the self. And all of these selves can then be seen as partaking in that deeper but less specific, less quantifiable or describable through language essence with a capital E, which we might call pure awareness or being or I am nature. These are the various cards I'm playing with at the moment in this existential cosmic lottery I call life. So here's the poem. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. This poem, like many of the poems I learnt a few years ago, is a somewhat cryptic and yet also fully open-hearted message in a bottle. Messages like this one, you may know, were also affixed to the side of the Voyager space probe in 1977, and some sort of poetry will probably be launched into the cosmos in 2027 for the 50th anniversary Voyager 3 launch, presided over by David Attenborough and Jeff Bezos. But these messages can, of course, be found everywhere in our talking animal culture, including a podcast like this one, or an unanswered love letter, or a podcast like this one, sent out as an unanswered love letter, so as to submit to the silence of the gods, so as to make that silence, their silence, more livable, lovable, something like that. All of these things are also wrapped up in William Stafford's poem, The Way It Is, including a song in a similar key called Philosophy by Ben Folds, the one playing in the background right now. A song I adore, a song I love. Also because Folds is a particularly good example of the Type 4 drama queen. You can hear this, even without lyrics, in the tonality of his inimitably needy, whiny voice. Not quite male, but not quite female. So let's just say non-binary or queer. But also in the wounded sentiments of his lyrics. Go ahead, you can say what you want, I've got my philosophy. And I bet you he does. Of course he does. Ben Folds will surely by now have some kind of philosophy in place, worked out for his Type 4 drama queen self. He wrote the song when he was 25, and 3 decades later he's still singing it, still holding on to his archetypal thread. I would surmise, though, for Folds is no fool, even if he plays the part, that whatever his philosophy is, it is probably designed to help him and others to deal with the ups and downs of being a drama queen four. So let's talk a little bit more about this philosophy, shall we? This thread that keeps our feet on the ground. What is it? And might it be found in some kind of archetypal recognition of the self with a capital S? To get us going, let's first enjoy a super fiery blast of Ben Folds' fourness. Something to take us into that space of inquiry that I call this thing.
Skyline at the motor blocking glass and check out the reflections in my eyes. See, they always used to be there, even when this all was grass, and I sang and danced about a high rise, and you were laughing at we
When I'm meeting someone for the first time, particularly in my role as a therapist, more than anything else, I think I'm trying to get a bit of a read on that person. Or maybe a better word for this would be, I'm trying to figure out what kind of flavor is intrinsic to the sweet and sour fruity entity presenting itself to my senses right at this moment. I think we all do this in some way. Consider the last person you met through some meaningful interaction, like on a date or at a party, someone you engaged with in a bid to make a connection with them, to get to know and understand them, with all the mislaid potential contained in those words. Knowing someone, understanding someone, and perhaps even trying to love someone once this knowing and understanding is underway. Knowing, loving, understanding, accepting, or at least trying to. These words are used all the time in psychological and psychotherapeutic discourse. And what they point to is a focus on our elemental or innate essence or flavor. Maybe one way to access archetype is if we can catch the human animal when they're not transmitting or broadcasting. I have this audio file, which I recorded on my phone a couple of weeks ago, of an Enneagram Type 4 who I've been getting to know recently. It's just them walking around their local park, dictating a couple of lines into their phone. When I listen to them, like when I'm listening to Ben Folds, I'm listening as much to the tonality and flow of this four, their archetypal energy, as much as anything else. What's the vibe here, I ask myself, and what makes this vibe particularly four-ish? You've now heard the whiny drama queen tones of Ben Folds' four. His band, as you may know, is called Ben Folds 5, but when it's just him, I think it's fair to call him Ben Folds 4. So, if that's the elemental and essential sound of, let's say, a four, what might other archetypes sound like? Does every archetype have its own sound, its own archetypal flavor? Well, of course it does. Let's say I played for you a snippet of a singer-songwriter type 9 and a singer-songwriter type 7. Do you think you could guess the type? I bet you could. Let's try this. I'm going to play for you a bit of Type 9, the peacemaker, easygoing, self-effacing, receptive, reassuring, agreeable. And I'm also going to play for you a Type 7, the enthusiast, busy, variety-seeking, spontaneous, versatile, but can also have problems with impatience and impulsiveness in their never-ending search for new and exciting experiences, their drug of choice being freedom and diversification when it comes to finding a self-cure for their pain. So here are the two clips, which is the peacemaker and which the enthusiast. You decide.
When you're down in trouble and you need some love and care,
might as well jump, jump. Might as well jump. Go ahead, jump, jump.
Could you hear that this was a 797 sandwich rather than a 979 one? Of course you could. James Taylor is an archetypal 9. He's got those gentle, loving Jesus vibes, and you can hear them straight away. Jesus was a 9. My ex-fiance, who I now like to think of as Beatrice Natalia, in homage to Dante's beloved Beatrice in Vita Nuova, was a 9. To be in her presence was to be enveloped by this kind of loving grace.
Just close your eyes and think of me. Yes, and soon I will be there. To brighten up, oh, even your darkest night.
You can see, or rather hear now, why I proposed and wanted to be with Beatrice Natalia for as long as my talking human animal body, the one that you are overhearing on this podcast, lived and breathed.
To see you again. It's winter, spring, summer, or fall. All you gotta do is call on me, and I will be there, yeah, yes, I'll be there. You've got a friend.
So with this premise about essential archetypal essence in mind, let me play for you that bit of tape, he says, pretending that we still live in an analogue world where essence is imbued in objects the way it no longer is for us metaverse moderns. I've been listening recently to these self-to-self voice notes from Mr. Four to see if I can detect his essential archetypal Four flavour in some way, once the self is stripped of some of its social performativity. Can we still hear the drama queen, even when the drama queen is being dramatic only for themselves? Or to put it more gently, are we able to hear somehow, even in the tonality of the voice, the sensitive, withdrawn type Four, expressive, dramatic, self-absorbed and temperamental? What is the flavour of this fruity Four? Mango? Kiwi? Banana? Or something much more wacky and odd, like caramel sapodilla, or a custard apple, durian, dragon fruit, or maybe even a kumquat? Well, you decide. Here's the tape. So, I'm on a break at the moment from my girlfriend. And we might get back together again. I'm not sure, but we might. You know, we're in that kind of like, maybe, maybe not. The break's going well, but we might get back together again. And that person who is, you know, if I had a rifle right now, and I could actually shoot the person who makes the loud klaxon sounding honking noises, that person who creates the honky tonk, I would do so. Jesus Christ. Okay. So we're on this break. But I want to tell you a little bit about her because I love her. I mean, that's why, obviously, you know, even though we're on a break, I'm like, might we reconnect? Might we find a way to get back together again? Should we find a way to get back together again? So my girlfriend, her name is, let me call her Green. Sometimes I call her Green Goodness. Sometimes I call her Green Goddess. Because, you know, I sort of worship her. I think that's important if you're in a relationship. You want to kind of worship the one you're with, you know, in a way. In a sort of sub-dom kind of way, maybe. Even if you're sort of more dom, but you might, for your partner, you might want to worship them. But this is also connected to Jeff Bezos, right? I'm not just like suddenly gone into navel-gazing mode. Well, it is navel-gazing mode. It is connected to Jeff Bezos because and the whole Voyager thing and all of that stuff in the last episode. Because for the last 3 months, basically, before we kind of went on a break, before we broke up. We were pretty much broken up. But I like to think of it also as like, well, maybe on a break. We're pretty much broken up. But anyway, in the last 3 months, we've had a kind of ritual. And the ritual is that, about, I don't know, up was 9, 10 o'clock. I mean, she was incredibly amenable and agreeable, which you have to be, I think, an amenable, agreeable person to kind of be in a relationship with me. Somewhat amenable, somewhat agreeable, also good boundaries, you know, that kind of thing. And she was incredibly amenable and agreeable. My ex. I'm going to refer to her now as just my ex. XGG. Ex. Because, you know, I would sort of finish clients around about 8. And maybe go for a walk with Max, a little quick final walk, see if he wants to deposit his turd somewhere. And then, you know, maybe stop cooking a little bit, make something. And then kind of think, okay, well, am I going to settle down with a book or am I going to settle down with, I don't know, a non-book? And unfortunately, in the last couple of months, it's generally been the non-book. Fortunately, unfortunately, I don't know. Because I've been thinking about this Voyager thing, and Attenborough and all of that good stuff. And I thought, well, I've decided, basically, that I will just watch every single nature program that David Attenborough has ever produced. Because I've seen some of them, but I mean, I haven't seen them all. And I thought, well, let me just plow my way through them so that... And the idea was twofold. I mean, one, to sort of just appreciate the majesty of this man's work. But I also thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if, like, I mean, if you know, the human race is on the way out, but we also, as individual humans, let's not forget, are currently living and at some point we'll be dead. And I thought, well, you know, that whole idea of, like, you know, life flashing before your eyes and all of that stuff. I thought, maybe if I just sit for however long it takes and watch every single David Attenborough, you know, piece of film that's ever been released into the public domain, maybe, just maybe, you know, in those last moments before I die, what I will see amongst all the other beautiful clutter of my life, I will see just the stream of compressed, never-ending... Well, for me, I mean, I'll see it in about a second before my brain goes bloop. But I will see this kind of never-ending stream of imagery and images of our world and of the creatures, of the non-human creatures. Because, you know, I spend all day with human creatures. I recognize a lot of myself in them, but, you know... They're not my favorite animals. Sorry, humans. I mean, obviously, I love the ones that are close to me, but you're not my favorite humans. You're not my favorite non-humans, I should say. Well, you're not my favorite animals. You're not really my favorite mammals, really, if I'm absolutely honest with you. I like the uncomplicated mammals because I find myself overly complicated. But I also like the super complicated. I mean, if I'm going to sit down, though, if that's it. If I'm going to sit down with any other human mammal, I would probably want to sit down with one who is also kind of complicated and messed up and sort of all over the place, which would be pretty much everyone. But then there's those people who kind of have some sort of consciousness of that, and there's those people who are just sort of like... just alive, and the former are the suffering ones and the latter are the, you know, they would be called like happy.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you, getting to like you, getting to hope you like me. Getting to know you, putting it my way.
While I'm working on the soundscape for this bit of Navel Gazing Fourness, I get a call from my mother. You remember her from episode one, right? In some sense, her initial phone call to me was kind of what birthed this project in the first place.
Hello?
Steve! Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, all right, I'm just cooking because Max and I are going to go for a little walk in the countryside today. I don't have clients this evening, so...
Nice because it's much cooler. Well, it's a lot cooler. It's a little bit sticky, but it's a lot cooler. You'll love it and you'll love it, so that's good.
So, yeah, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. I just wanted to say to you, I think Mark's a bit miffed, hey?
About what?
That you didn't disguise his voice. You know,
oh my God, really?
Yeah, I think...
You didn't say anything to me, though. You didn't say anything to me.
Did he ask you not? He asked you to disguise it.
Okay, so he said some nice things. He said he really enjoyed it, and he sent me like this amazing list of, I don't know, ways I could improve it. But it wasn't like, he didn't write in like capital letters, change my voice. I thought he kind of got it that... It was a bit of a joke, and then, you know, people thought
people would think, okay, is that his voice? Isn't that his voice? It was sort of, you know, in jest. And also, I mean, how many people are listening to this? About 50?
I mean,
Most of them are family members. I mean, who cares?
I mean, it's just...
Why does he need his voice changed?
It's just an impression. Just an impression. I think he should
Has he said something to you? When you spoke to him, did he say
something? Well, it's just an impression I got. It's not... wasn't a direct...
What did he say?
I thought Stephen was going to disguise my voice, and it didn't sound much like he did. Or did, you know, he didn't.
Well, of course it didn't sound like it, because I didn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean...
So don't you think it's a good idea just to phone and apologise to him? What do you think?
Wow.
Go on.
I mean, if I apologise, then I have to change the voice. Then I have to... And genuinely, this is going to be such a pain. You don't know how it works. I use this program called Hindenburg, and I'd have to find, I don't know, some app that I could then load up into the program. Oh, I don't...
But maybe...
It would take me like 3 hours to change the 5 minutes of him speaking.
But maybe you could just suggest to him that you do it the next time.
But I don't want to.
Oh, I see.
I just want...
Oh, I see.
I mean, I'm going to speak to him because I'm sure he's going to have a few choice comments to make about the way that I've put together the last couple of episodes. But so I will speak to him, but at the same time, I just don't want to... I just think it's better not change. I mean, you know, he's got this kind of slightly clipped voice anyway, so I'm like, So I kind of... As soon as I start messing around with that, he's going to become impossible to understand.
Oh, okay. Well, it's
I don't
just
know, don't you experience
suggestion.
Him like that? Don't you think that his voice is a bit like that?
No.
No? It's a bit sort of like, no?
No, I don't. But then I'm not listening for what you're listening to, you see. I mean, obviously, hearing and listening for something I'm not hearing and listening for. It's just a suggestion. Think about it and you can decide what you want to do.
You know... Okay.
Okay,
anyway,
then just leave
it. Thank you for telling me. I wasn't aware that he was coughing.
Quick sidebar on the term coughing, from the verb to koch, literally to cook. My mother and I use the Yiddish term to refer to someone who is fretting or seething or stewing in their frustration. But I think this is particular to the dialect of our family. I can find no other examples of this usage online. My mother tells me when I query this that the dispossessed Poles and Lithuanians who landed up in South Africa before and after the Holocaust used bits of broken Yiddish as a lingua franca to communicate with the other Jews who didn't share their mother tongue. Thus, neologisms like koch, perhaps borrowed from the more common Yiddish expression of kochleffel, which means a cooking spoon, often used in soup, but it also has the idiomatic meaning of someone who is a meddler, a busybody, a shit stirrer. This came into being from words that had been brought from the home country and were then used by that sliver of 20th century diaspora who donated their sad, bad, and mad genes to the making of this four.
No, it wasn't coughing?
No, there wasn't that. Just an impression I got.
But how did he say it? Was he like, oh, I thought he was going to disguise my voice, but he didn't?
No, I didn't get that impression. It wasn't as bad as that. It's just me, as always, hearing things, you know, I read between the lines and just suggesting them.
You're a type four, so I guess that's your prerogative. Yeah.
Just give it some thought and then you decide, all right?
All right. Okay, cheers, Ma.
That's all I was going to say.
Yeah, cool,
all right.
Cool.
Enjoy your walk.
Thanks. Bye.
So this four flavour that you can hear in both Mother and Son and also in Ben Fold's four that I've played on this episode. As with all archetypes, there are two sides and many phases to this four moon. The moon that often, in my experience, desires to be a satellite to a planetary archetype 9. Some of the better relationships in my life have always been with type 9s. This is how it felt with my former fiancée Beatrice Natalia. I was a satellite moon to her planetary nine. Nines, you see, hold all the archetypes in their being, including those satellite personalities who circle around them, those moon-like fours who are sometimes dark and sometimes bright, but more often than not, both shadow and light, which makes them so confusing to the other archetypes, especially the nines. I think the clinical psychologist Beatrice Chestnut gives the most even-handed description of the self I live within and through, called four.
This four archetype can also be found in Jung's concept of the shadow, defined as the inferior parts of the personality. While type threes over-identify with a persona or the positive aspects of ourselves we highlight in the public face we show to the world, type fours over-identify with those parts of ourselves we'd rather others didn't see. Although fours may also recast their sense of deficiency as being special or unique as a way of valuing themselves on a surface level, they identify with a deficient self more than an idealized self. The four archetype also represents the archetype of the tragic artist who suffers in the service of artistic self-expression. It suggests an idealistic vision of the value of emotions, especially the way in which authentic emotions are usefully expressed through art in a mode that inspires, moves, and unites people. The four's resonance with the shadow can also be seen in the fact that they have a natural gift for understanding the deeper emotional level of experience and seeing the beauty in darker emotions that other types would rather not feel, much less acknowledge. This can make them feel dangerous to others on an unconscious level, as fours may raise the issue of authentic emotions that others would often rather not deal with. Type 4s are thus the prototype for that part in all of us that feels dissatisfied with who we are. We all have the capacity to feel bad about what we see as our flaws and to grieve and long for what we see as lacking in our lives. We can all become depressed in the face of feeling inadequate when we don't fit the idealized image of what we believe we have to be to get the love we want. This archetype thus represents the tendency we all have to develop an inferiority complex, which makes it difficult to feel good about ourselves and take in what is good from the outside. The natural strengths of type 4s include their large capacity for emotional sensitivity and depth, their ability to sense what is going on between people on the emotional level, their natural feel for aesthetics and creativity, and their idealistic and romantic sensibility. Relatively unafraid of intense feelings, fours value the expression of authentic emotion and can support others with great care, respect, and sensitivity when they are experiencing painful emotions. Fours are highly empathic and can see the beauty and power in painful feelings that other types habitually avoid.
Okay, so there you go. Swings and roundabouts, a bit like all of us, I guess. Just with added drama, and that's the problem. When I first found out about this archetype, I thought, what a bummer. But in the last few weeks, I've been doing some therapy with a four called Emily, a four who struggles with eco-anxiety. I found Emily by offering some free therapy on a climate crisis Facebook group. Our talks have reminded me how potentially lovable us fours can be. Something I haven't been feeling very much of in the last 6 or 7 months.
Uh-oh. You know, things are not good. Well, could you sort of talk a little bit about that?
Oh, that's a very good question. My dad used to comment on the amount of water we used to use in our bath. And like, oh, water doesn't grow on trees. Like, we need to watch our water waste. When I went to Indonesia, we used to only have a shower in like an egg cup of water, things like that. And he always like made us very aware. Whereas my mother is the complete opposite. She's very I don't know, luxurious? Like, doesn't really think of these things. Like, she wants to have a nice shower and feel clean, so nothing's going to stop her from getting that. So I grew up in a household with very, like, conflicting points of view. I think it's carried on with me because if I'm not in a room, I will, like, turn off the light or something. And my mum always is like, I'm using that room. And we're always having, like, strange arguments where I don't even think it an issue. And she really does, but it upsets me. I feel like I'm very conscious about the amount of energy that we use. And if I can just do my little bit to save any bit of energy, like, I will. But I think I've become a bit too obsessive with it. Like, if I get a plastic bag, like, I will use it 10 times before I throw it away, because it feels like something that I can control. I get anxious for a second and then I bring myself out of it and, which is probably unhealthy, because I just distract.
When you say bring yourself out, in what way?
Well, just, like, I find it really, I don't know, creepy crawly feeling that you get that, like, I don't know, let me think of an example. Like what we're talking about, feeling bad about using, about flying. I just get to this point where I'm like, there's nothing I can, I can't stay in that place of, like, fear. And I have a lot of friends who suffer from anxiety, and they often come to me, and I never understand why. Because my approach is to just, like, stop thinking about it, or, like,
Yeah, that's what we all do.
I've noticed, I think it's moments. I think sometimes I have, moments where I'm like, oh, no. Yeah, this can't end well. And it takes up a lot of my time. But then most of the time, I just try and look at it. I just try and look at it positively. Like, I work with kids, and I try and tell myself, this is something I can maybe make a small difference with, like, working with the next generation. But they're tiny, so, like, lots of them are graduating this week, and I'm realizing I'm like trying to spout loads of wisdom, but they are three.
What's the graduation ceremony?
Oh my god, yeah. So we are singing, this is really hilarious, we've changed the words to R. Kelly, which is a really inappropriate person, the greatest moment, or something. I don't know, this song.
What's the R. Kelly song?
It's called The Greatest Man, something about mountains.
Okay, I'll look it up. Oh, that's brilliant.
I am a mountain, I am a tall tree, oh, I am a swift wind, sweeping the country. I am a river, down in the valley, oh, I am a vision, and I can see clearly. If anybody asks you who I am, just stand up tall, look them in the face and say, I'm that star up in the sky, I'm that mountain peak up high. Hey, I made it, I'm the world's greatest. I'm that little bit of hope, when my back's against the road, greatest.
In the next few episodes, I'm going to go off on a bit of a tangent, but not entirely. Having got into the Enneagram in a bid to discover Bezos' core type, I've been reading a lot of Gurdjieff recently, whose inquiries into self and soul laid the foundation for all these explorations in human essence. One of his most famous books is called Meetings with Remarkable Men. Personally speaking, I haven't really met any remarkable men in the last few years, but I have met three very remarkable women. a type 9, who I now call Beatrice Natalia, a type 6, who I'm currently speaking to every day for about an hour, called Roz, and a type 3, who you've already met, called Kate. I want to spend the next few episodes exploring my meetings with these remarkable women and what they have taught me. All the Bezos Attenborough space stuff will still be in the mix, but being a Channel 4 production by now, as you can probably tell, I guess this exploration is going to go where all my explorations go, via some heart-led path. I'm that little bit of hope when my back's against.